Hello again. My name is John Rhodes, and this is Mystic Babylon Open Mic Poetry Podcast coming from near the Hate in San Francisco. This is March 19th, and I usually record every 2 weeks, and this is my fourth recording. I have been experimenting with different sound effects for my podcast, and in the past I have been dubbing a special effect over the recordings, which is called Cavernous Sound. This time I am going to leave it out just to see if I get a clearer sound that way. The effect was nice, but it hissed slightly when the sound echoed and reverberated, so I'm going to try to see how the podcast sounds without the doctoring. Leave a comment on the website stating the way you like the sound if you can. Also post a comment about what you think of my podcast. I appreciate the feedback. We are having two poets read today. One poet I met at the open mic at the Gallery Cafe located near the Cable Car Museum near Chinatown. It runs the first Monday of the month at 7 o'clock. The exact address is 1200 Mason at Washington. It is run by a lady named Robin Demers, who is going to read in the podcast 2 weeks from now, so tune in. The second poet is a friend of the poet I met at the Gallery Cafe. They both will introduce themselves in detail before they read. I will read first, as usual, three of my poems. If you would like to experience more of my poetry, you can buy my book, Spirits of Bondage and Inherent Transcendence, almost anywhere on the net. My website is rhodespoetry.com. The Open Mic Poetry Podcast will start shortly. My first poem I will read is entitled Bric-a-Brac. The brick part of the title is spelt like brick, as in brick and mortar. The poem is about a compulsive fantasy I have that wickedness is almost built into the very buildings we live in, and somehow we have to remove it without tearing down the actual structures and edifices that will hold up our society. I will now start reading. The bricklayer must sing, and the building he builds should house kind-hearted gentry, not a machine. The remnants of a foundation from the past should not be shrouded in mystery where previous shadows of gloom of predestination are cast. We can't always live with a broken-down spirit in a broken-down house where our stepfather Inquisition has exiled us for trying to fortify our spirits and reinforce what we espouse. The reactionary inappropriateness of the footloose thrower of bricks sometimes delves into the meaning and origin of the elusive built-up bigotry that prevents a man from building a castle and instead must dig a ditch. The keystone should extend its support to the strengthening and building of the pier so as to hold back the landslides which tear down the courthouse and cause the weak to experience fears. We have to trick the shams to testify against themselves so their building will fall down in shambles, all because of themselves. Thank you. My second poem is The Wolf and the Grapes. This is a lament about the barely identified wolves of society who hound the honest man, squeezing his spirit out of his body, making him feel lonesome and without any sustenance, leaving him without anyone to lend him a hand. In his case, the wolves have taken all his contacts and many times have left him to die. I will start reading. The wolf shafted innocence and the muse doctored the blues. The loafing man loathes the credit due that is given to those who wear workers' clothes, and of work consider that type of labor a cliché, a quirk, or one of many similar woes. The anonymous sinner speaks as the undying mind of the saint seeks. The wolf doesn't stand but leans, and extraordinarily, in unison with others, was on human kindness weaned. Dire straits are mind-benders that bend the mind, and simultaneously poor people fall behind. Does the wolf twist the branches of the vine to squeeze blood out of the grapes for wine? And to man is this an omen or a sign? The wolf will never face the day, and he will say that in the future I will get my way. Thank you. The last poem is called My Best Friend the Thief. This poem speaks of the feeling we all have of inseparability from sin. No matter how aloof and distant we think we are from the thieves who we nailed by the side of Jesus, we can't help but think and feel guilty that they were up there close to Jesus when he died. I will start reading shortly. I saw the thief next to Jesus on Golgotha, and without getting cross, asked him, "Did you turn over a new leaf? Oh, and by the way, what's the beef?" I told him he was faking it and should come right down, but he said he saw a snake down there and started to sweat and frown. He said he didn't like people calling him a thief because it was his belief that this caused stigma and grief. I said if he came down, I would give him a steak. He stared down at me and down at the ground and said I should cook the snake. He said, asking me why, if I called him my friend, did I follow him around looking for his shortcomings all over again. I told him I didn't know where I was bound, and it was either me or him as I howled like a hound. I asked him why being a thief was such a denial, and he said, to not think you're normal and lose your soul on the cross was singularly vile. And as to whether he thought himself hip, he said he would gladly go to jail for life or sail on a fool ship if he could get off this cross he did quip. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Christopher Bernard. I've long lived in San Francisco and published fiction and criticism and poetry, both here, locally, and across the country. I'm going to begin reading from my recent novel, which was published by Regent Press in 2005. It is called A Spy in the Ruins. It's divided into 10 chapters with a prologue and an epilogue, and I'll be reading the prologue. A Spy in the Ruins. It hit like a hammering on a door, lifting the room on its edge and rattling it with an imaginary break a moment at the tip, before dropping it into a long, ferocious shaking, like a bone in the mouth of a dog. Books slithering from a case, the phone splitting and scattering over the rug, CDs slipping from the shelves as the kitchen rang with breakage. The room's frame creaked and squealed around you, torquing in the ground roll, wave following wave, cracking the plaster across from you as you crouched in the doorway. The doorframe bends, the door slowly swings away. Something booms far below. The building had been raised on a single square of concrete. You imagine the long diagonal fork of black lightning split its face. Yet you feel almost calm, riding a wave as you used to do as a child, throwing yourself into the curl of the surf, crashing toward the foam of waves, already spent in a chug of spume and froth. And it keeps rolling. The apartment building across the street sways gently like a giant cradle as you see the squares of transparency fall like large glassy snowflakes from the building's face, and you realize it is windows falling, and you hear the squish and rattle of the rain of shattering glass along the street, and the rolling seems to go on endlessly until, as abruptly as it hit, it stopped. And silence and darkness fill the room. The evening air outside suffused with pale luminescence, white as the moon, edged yellow-pink with sunset. And the street you looked down from the window you hastened to, as soon as the shock ceased and you could keep your balance, the street is shadowy with houses sagging into the darkness of the defile as far as you can see, dimly east and west. Small grayish smudges that only with an effort you realize are people, dazed, walking, their eyes stare up into the air. Perhaps the shock fell from the sky, and more might come from there. The smudge of smoke and fog that usually lies torpid over the city half hides the towers downtown, rising blank and lightless in the twilight. And only then do you hear, moving across the city, from all around you, wave on wave of the wailing of sirens. And distantly, across a multitude of blurring and deepening roofs, a blacker smudge turns toward the dusk like a fist of darkness slowly unclenching toward the sky. The yellow-red spark in its grip, the only answer to the evening star, which, at that moment, opens its red eye over the shaken city as the fires begin. And wake and stare into the darkness around you. And wake for the shaking to begin again, the spasm and stab again, the seed of the nightmare again to burn in the darkness of a sleep that will not come. But it too does not come. You wait for the burning of the city, the fire that eats you, the loss of love, of happiness, of hope, the wreckage of a life at the edge of your life that you now inhabit, that now inhabits you like the larva of a wasp eating you from within. Or is it not, rather, laying you waste under bombardment, and disappearing in a haze of sirens and cries? You pass the rubble through your fingers like sand, and disappear in a smoke of blazing hair. Try to fold your body back to sleep like a knife, hoping the nightmare won't resume, hoping it will, hoping against hope for the abandonment today, hoping against hope against the abandonment today. But it does not come, as on every night, and breaking into fragments of many of your days, even when it does not come as now. Hoping to find in the dreams between sleep the thread that snapped in the scissors' teeth, the palace that fell and fired in the loss of joy, the city that burned to the grave of its memory, the kingdom that collapsed between the battle that lost the war, and the whispering of blind historians who insult its memory by trying to revive it. And you wait in the wreckage of a life contained like a seed in the wreckage of love, since that it is what it is meant to have been all about, wasn't it? Was it not? Where is it? The nightmare again. Flung. Out. Far. Across a wide and opening field as of seeds or stones or birds dispersed by wind or the force of migration or a series of swift kicks. The sound of shouts driving seagulls up a beach. Or the storm coming. The shadows on a summer porch. A pattern of sycamore leaves. The trash burning in a tower of stones. That, yes, yellow rocks. He smears his tongue with the ash. I smear my tongue with the ash. The sky opening like a palm cut with crescents where the fingernails bit into the skin. Sand in your cuff, a conch in your hand. A broken pattern taking its revenge. An execution rose, encrypted in panels of sand, crumbling as you read them, sifting through your fingers, the words, sifting through your eyes, the web of dust in the tool shed, the bottom of the property where the solitary one sat long ago in a back corner against the rotting joists, staring into the rafters and the shadows. The smell of rot piercing sweet, like the gull decaying on the levee rampant, flaring into the earth, smelling of the earth your mother, whom you have never No. That is the prologue from my first novel, A Spy in the Ruins, published by Regent Press last year. If you'd like to learn more about A Spy in the Ruins, please visit Amazon.com or the website of the publisher, Regent Press, www.regentpress.net. The next piece I'm going to read is a poem in response to an art show exhibit that I saw a couple of years ago at the Palace of the Legion of Honor in San Francisco of Chinese artifacts. There was one piece there that particularly impressed me. It's a full-scale statue of a young soldier that had been dug out of the immense grave of the first emperor of China many centuries ago. He was buried there with thousands of other like statues representing the emperor's army and his chattel and servants who were buried in image with him, with the actual body of the first emperor of China. The piece is called The Archer. I was put together from 1,000 shattered pieces hidden in dirt of Qian, under fields where oxen dumbly staggered and sun-blackened farmers sweated the soil into reluctant, stunted gifts. I kneeled with my brothers, a guardian army loyal to the webbed dust of the father. The pits spread with us, wheeled from the hub in arc and spoke of the tomb of the sovereign at the foot of the sovereign sky, a broken fan to mask the sun of heaven from the death of death, release to barbarian light. We listened as spring rose were hoed above us, a scratching on our tomb like the sound of spiders skittering across the darkness. The summer roots crept down and touched us tenderly as if to capture us and to draw us back to day. We overheard the stamp of Tatar horses and waves of fire that slash through sudden years, the battles fading into desolation and the walls that rose from fields of dust and bone, the moderate diplomatic pro and con of merchants debating price and yield and season, lovers scything the grass with promises and abrupt cessation or abrupt consent. And out of the west, the coming of the white tigers, returning our toys to us in mouths of flame. All one to us, who left all that behind to guard the darkness and forget time. The living walked lightly over us, the old grew weary, the lotus passed across us and away. The children of the light filled our dark vaults with fanatic cries and faltered into shame, their faces hot with the mirror's accusation. And we still waited, almost earth again, ground into little triangles of clay, frozen in the cold sunlessness of waiting, until one day, in a time that knew no days, the diggers, in a long, dry, desperate season, tapped and water-witched and muttered, "Here." It was just above my shoulder, where my quiver had long disintegrated. I was caught at the moment when my bow was almost raised. I had just glimpsed the danger come from far, my eyes alert, my fingers fumbling at the blow, testing its grip, when, after the millennia, a spade pierced the roof and broke a sudden white star and unburied us today, revealing us, dazed, uncertain, forever, in loyal service to the Emperor. I look at you, wondering, dazzled, wary, my eyes wincing in these torrents of light. I look through you toward the strange walls past your shoulder, and past the walls toward the blazing, blinding horizon, from gate of horn to gate of ivory. I look, aching with longing for my Emperor, as my eyes, my ears, my mouth wall with clay. O Chin, have we failed? Or is this our victory? The next poem I'm going to read appeared in an issue of Caveat Lector, a magazine that I edit and write for. If you'd like to visit Caveat Lector online, please go to www.caveat-lector.org. The last piece I'm going to read is a poem based on nostalgic memories from my childhood and teenage years and youth in Philadelphia. It's called Lord of the Birds. Exploding in a fan of wings, channels and rivers of flight long dammed in, released like a trigger in a rush of feathers, a cackling of beaks, they pour through the empty gates of the air, a living cascade charged dark in the evening, a spillway over a dam of light, spuming across the library roof, the trees, a cathedral dome, a spire pointing toward the evening star. A sluice and fall of wings and whistling, pointing everywhere like a compass gone wild, yet held in a clasp as firm as a hand, and seen from a plane, a satellite camera, the moon's imaginary eye, they act as one, launch flight as one, from the winter snows like a single drop on an apple's skin, drawn from the sky like leaves, together vanish out of the white sky over the white land. Thank you very much.
Three. Hi. My name is Ruby Miranda Cerreto. I've been writing poetry for 25 years or so. I fell in love and started and haven't stopped. My first poem is Heartburn. My heart, a palpable, heavy, separate weight, it flutters erratically against its cage, ponderous and ephemeral as dancing elephants. I was in a bar. They had the sound turned off on the TV. and we're playing MTV. This is called MTV Without the Sound. A screen of dancing girls, then Marilyn, then Norma Jean, then Marilyn, outnumbering a crowd, sucking kisses from her palm, waving, and then three tank tops dressed in rock and roll. Oh, you original, you who died for shallowness, how deep will you become? How many layers, however thin? Apology for a grievous offense. Sorry, snaps her brother, meaning no, I'm not. Sorry, says her playmate, meaning I didn't mean to hurt you. I am sorry, says her teacher, meaning if you'd just try harder. Well, I'm sorry, says her date, meaning little Miss Two Shoes aren't you. Oh, I'm sorry, says her friend, meaning I'll try to get the stain out. I'm sorry, stammers her roommate, meaning are you on the rag or what? I'm sorry, whispers her first love, meaning I really thought that it was true. My God, I'm sorry, says her neighbor, meaning how much was that thing worth to you? I'm really sorry, says her girlfriend, meaning I know that I was wrong. I'm sorry, smiles her lover, meaning I only wish I could give you palaces and emeralds and stars. I am so sorry, says the doctor, meaning there was nothing I could do. Sorry, lady, says the sales clerk, meaning maybe if you'd tell me what you want. I'm sorry, says her sister, meaning I didn't really understand that that was how it was for you. Can you forgive me? I'm sorry, really, cries her child, hand still in the cookie jar. I'm very sorry. On being called Felicity. We are similar in height, coloring, texture of hair, but I am sudden and often shrill. Your even words are made of music. How could he mistake your hesitant wisdom for my braggadocio? Pity the man who cannot tell one witch from another. Educational TV. I learned something tonight. I watched an ostrich look around and do a thing that ostriches are famous for. I didn't know that ostriches could do. It scouted out the land, sashayed its preposterous ostrich way to its chosen proper place among the boulders and the sand, and looked around. It folded wings and tail down. The puffs of smoky plumes went poof and disappeared. It lifted up one leg like a flamingo and set it down, then raised the other and looked around. It folded both legs down and sat. The monstrous thighs that signify an ostrich disappeared beneath it and left a sitting swan. I'd never seen an ostrich look like a bird before. It stretched its white neck up and looked around, then out and looked a formal full-stretched circle all the way around, and then it tilted forward and snaked its neck out straight along the ground. With a last low look, it laid its head down flat and disappeared. It left a boulder sitting there, half buried in the sand. Summer afternoon. Tiny, thin, bright strips of sky shine bluely through the slotted screen. Stillness hovers in the house. Huge, hanging shadows haunt the air. Lovely, large, loose stripes of light fall whitely on the mottled wall. A friend of mine died. I wrote this. It's called Pattern for Cross Stitch, for use of spires. October. Twilight seen from underneath a sycamore. Its leaves more green than yellow, more gold still than rust, more angled branch and ash gray twig than leaf. more purpling sky, edged crimson than twig and leaf together. Another leaf drifts, free. The sea mage and the merking's fool. I dive in my depths, testing stamina and courage. I dive and drift along the reefs, and dive to look among the rocks, and dive to peer between the strands of kelp. I dive and swim the deepest places I can reach, where finally I see the broken, sunken rib cage of a ship, an artifact of olden peoples, forever younger than I can ever be. I dive and puzzle out the hold and try to find the captain's quarters. I dive to learn the secrets of sea change. I dive and reconstruct the tide and dig and dive and try to read the minds of ancient sailors. I dive to be the sea. I study languages of fish so I can ask where treasure may be found. I dive and search and dig and dive. At last I find a precious insight, gleaming, obvious in the sand in a spot I know I've searched 10 times before. I carry it to sunshine, clean it of sea incrustation, learn its shape, begin to know its uses. I keep it in a special place, locked from harm or possibility of loss, velvet cushioned. One day I show it to a friend, amusing in his shallow sparkle, who shows no sign of knowing how to swim. He says, "Oh, look," and digging in the pocket of his jeans, he comes up with my treasure's twin. He tells me how he found it as he waded in the surf, saw its gleam, picked it shining up. "Look," he says, "they're just alike." And my final poem, Menagerie. Is your back like a wall curved tightly around your hands and your heart to defend me from the fangs, claws, and fear of the beasts that prowl, trapped inside its perimeter? Freed from the fear of the fact of the wall, I begin to see through as bricks melt into bars. Or do I imagine? You are an unlikely zoo, my love. I like circus better. In circuses, danger is fraught with beauty, deliciously courted, delicately sidestepped, flaunted for show. Beasts are respected, but lions are made to lie down with tigers, lambs in between, for the amusement of girls from the country. There are clowns. Thank you very much. I have a book, a chapbook named Note to Hook, that can be bought from City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco. Thank you.
This ends Mystic Babylon's 4th recording. I hope you enjoyed it. Come back again. Thank you.